You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Now, the Go Wild app has added some really cool and exciting functionality to their app. And the first one I want to talk about is the Near Me function. And basically what this does, it allows you to engage and connect with people in your area. You guys can talk about gear. You guys can talk about hunting areas. You guys can talk about what's going on in the woods. And it just allows the users to be more of a community and connect easier. The second part is the Gearbox. And what the Gearbox is, it is an opportunity for the users to not only see reviews on products and see what the Go Wild community is using in the field, what products they're using, but it also allows you guys to purchase up to 150,000 products. There's a shopping function on it. So check out the Go Wild app. If you haven't downloaded it to your phone yet, you need to, and you can do that at any app store that is currently available. Go Wild. It's an awesome app. Check them out.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, guys, welcome back, Land and Legs Podcast. Right in the middle of outside, a summer evening. If you want to capture the ambient sound of August,
here it is.
In the Ozarks, this is it. You hear the cicadas singing. This right here is when I was a 7-year-old to a 32-year-old. That this sound right here always has this depressing side effect of schools getting ready to start. And I haven't been to school in since 10 years probably.
You know what it is for me? Like, I love an early summer morning. Like, I know it sounds weird, but like that 5:45, 6:30 kind of time frame in a morning, like everything is still so quiet, but there's so much light, and I don't know. I love
no
it.
No thanks.
Tomorrow.
It's muggy.
No, tomorrow.
Drive down the road, and your window is going to be, you're going to have defrost on cold, then you have to switch it to warm, and you have to roll the window down. That's what
you
I think
you just keep
of.
Their windows down, and you just roll, because temperature's a little bit lower. Did you see, though, tomorrow night here is like 56?
Yeah.
I told my wife, I was like, literally, I might get up at 6 and just go outside. Just because I just want to feel what 56 degrees.
Do that.
I probably will. And then the next day it's 57.
I guarantee you, call me and I ain't going to answer. But, we're right in the middle of summer, so lots of food planting going on right now. And so we got a lot of hearsay, I guess we should say. Hearsay, myths, ideas. It's just a total.
Followed up with truth.
Yeah, we're just talking about things we're seeing, trying, testing, hearing, seeing, whatever you want to call
it. Let's say addressing the August questions.
Yeah.
Which may sound boring, but honestly, there's a lot of really good tidbits that we've touched on going into this podcast that I think really would be kind of eye-opening for some people of the myths of germination and how that works based on, just science and what happens with seeds, why they grow, how they grow, what kind of planting techniques will work, and then some species that we're seeing becoming very, very popular in certain ways. So we're going to cover a lot of those things. And, isn't it still wild to believe that it's like, I guess this will release, August 4th? And month and like a week we'll be getting in the stand. That's just wild to believe. Antlers are really, they're formed, mineralization's going on, hardening of antlers, and I hope everyone is experiencing on their trail cameras lots of really good deer popping up, showing up, seeing what they're going to finish out to be. But this is just, I think, that same window of that mineralization of antlers, the hunter excitement level just drastically increases. It just parallels with this time frame because seasons are coming, food plot planting's going in, stands are being moved around, lanes cut.
Before we jump into it, though, we need to first thank one of our partners to make this podcast possible. And it kind of goes in right with the timing of the year, but that is First Light. Mm-hmm. You can check them out at firstlight.com. That's FIRSTLITE.com. Man, guys, gals, some awesome stuff. But most importantly, now's the time you need to get that stuff. Start getting it washed, getting it prepped, because deer season will be here very, very soon. You know, we've been wearing it through a couple of seasons and absolutely love the stuff. And we just had to upgrade or get a few more items.
And what just released is their new zip-off thermal bottoms.
That's right.
So if you're walking to the stand, zip them off, put them back on once you get there, once you get cold. Kind of a new little deal for this year, but I think it has a lot of application for the hunter who's walking in and out, long distance into stands, whatever, just maintaining that kind of regulation of temperature.
The base layers that I love are the furnace. They're the cold weather, very warm mm-hmm. ones. So this is what's great for me that I'm very excited about. That was part of my order, was the furnace boot top zip-offs. So I'll throw those in my pack, and I will walk to my stand, and then once I get to the stand, I'll take my pants down to the ground, basically around my boots. I won't have to take my boots off, and then I'll put those zip-up base layers on, and I won't have to even roll down my socks because they're boot top. They'll go right over them, but I won't have to, like, push them down or get them into my rubber boots, and then voila, I'm good to go. So very excited about that. Check them out at firstlight.com. Okay, so, man, there's so many questions. And while we're doing this, I'm going to go through some random questions if I can find some. Goodness, there's a lot of Instagram stuff on here. But lots of questions and lots of comments and lots of high school kids driving by right now.
they all got cool mufflers. But you know, one of the things I think that we should certainly address first that will kind of lay a foundation for the podcast is what we discussed earlier pre-show of how seeds germinate and why it's important to understand that foundation as then we discuss the different techniques and way that planting can be done, because I know that's probably some of the questions that have come in too, like, hey, will this work? Do you think this is going to work? What's my best option here? I have this and this. What should I do? So seeds germinating, what's important, like when we're talking about how things should grow, how many times have we heard seed to soil contact, moisture, sunlight?
And seed selection is another big one. We didn't talk about pre-show, but
clean seed bed is another one, or firm seed bed,
or too wet, too dry.
Yeah, the adequate
so
moisture. But all those are, let's say, phrases, things that people have heard that you gotta get done. You're right, or if you don't do that, you'll have bad success.
Preparation to a successful food plot. Let's just sum it up with that. You hear different ideas, different techniques, different things. But one of the big ones that all that stuff we just talked about, whether it be herbicide preparation, the techniques you used, it doesn't matter if it's $150 a bag or $50 a bag. It doesn't matter if it's the premier seed or what's labeled, or they tell you through marketing that it's the premier seed, or it's the stuff you just go and get in a scoop at the hardware store.
Yeah.
If you don't have the ideal conditions or the right conditions, it doesn't matter how much you pay for it. It won't be successful.
Correct.
And I think so many times people will plant a whatever, a blend or a monoculture, and have it would almost be an interesting poll to see how many times people have a vision of what they want this food plot to look like, and then did it actually turn into that? Because I think a lot of people would say it's never what you hoped for.
Yeah.
It's whatever. It's weedier than you hoped for. It's not as tall as you hoped for. The turnips didn't get as big as you hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
And conditions are a big part of that. And
planting conditions, for
and,
sure.
And growing conditions.
Yes.
Like, you may get great, it may be perfect scenario for planting. You come back in a month, you're like, where's it at? What happened? Well, maybe it didn't rain.
I put the seed here.
Yeah.
And you see, like, four sprigs.
I had germination 4 days afterwards. Uh-huh. Yeah, but you had 2 weeks of severe heat.
Nothing.
And you disc it, so it all just baked. You had cooked green beans out there.
Yeah, yeah. No shade. Your moisture was gone. It was a horrible situation.
Yeah.
That happens. So it certainly happens late summer.
Best advice in food plotting will always be have a little perspective and make sure that you are living in reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. too many times we think, well, this doesn't look anything like it looks like on the bag.
Yes.
Well, you don't know what went on to get it to look like that on the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that we see a lot of guys struggle with this time of the year.
Well, I think the thing that's often missed when it comes to just the overall germination of seeds is the moisture standpoint.
Yes.
Like, when you brought up a good point earlier was when a food plot company or a seed grower is doing a germination test. So they have to obviously label on the food plot bag what the germination rate is or percentage for that specific blended bag, right? So they test it. They don't put the seed in the ground and then wait and wait and wait for it to happen. The test is completed by getting a paper towel, spraying water on it, putting the seeds in there, and then laying the paper towel over itself, and then now you have moisture and paper towel with seeds in the middle, right?
Yeah.
Flip it back over after a couple of days. See which ones sprout. There's your germination rate. Maybe it's 9 seeds out of 10. Well, 90% germination rate.
Or cool. 90 out of 100.
Right. So that's how it's done. It's not in soil.
Yeah.
It's based on moisture. So if you're going through and you're prepping your food plots and completely disking and then waiting days and days and days, then you plant and you don't get rain for days and days and days, well, now you've just created a seed bed that was robbed of moisture.
Yeah.
And then you put the seed in it, and we know that seed was a 90% germination tested rate when it had moisture and no soil. And then you just you can't go forward and think that you're going to have great success if you don't have adequate soil moisture. Like, mm-hmm. that is so key. Well, and the other thing, how many times do we see wheat seed or rye seed thrown in the back of a truck and gets pushed to the back or, you know, pushed to the side and it rains the next day and 2 days later, 3 days later, you're like, what the heck? There's wheat growing in the back of my truck. Yeah, it can grow anywhere. It's going to pop. It's going to green up when there's moisture. Like, it's going to happen. So don't prepare a seed bed and rob itself of moisture ahead of time. I don't get that.
No.
Like, you can't, and or don't plant, don't broadcast, or if it's been super dry, don't drill it without knowing that there's rain coming. Like, if that top portion where the seed itself is going, whether it's broadcast and sitting on top, or it is drilled in the first inch, and there's no moisture there, it's not going to germinate until there's moisture. So don't plant when there's no rain.
Don't plant when there's no rain. Try not to plant when there's... I think this is a big thing, too. And this should be... Anybody who's listening should do this just to start to learn how a seed thrives or how a seed does best. And when you look at just the simple germination test, take 10 seeds and put them on a paper towel, you can do some rough math and say, okay, I'm gonna replicate a 1-inch rainfall in 20 minutes, and I'm gonna coat that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I could do is replicate that 1-inch rainfall and then don't water it for 4 days and leave it in the windowsill. But then take it and go, okay, I'm going to replicate a 1/4-inch rainfall for the next 4 days and see which one does better.
Mm-hmm.
And what you should really try to focus on is getting moisture over a period of time, not looking at, okay, I've disked or I've plowed, I've turned the soil up, I've voided this soil of moisture, and I put this seed into a powder. Might as well be sand. It's got no moisture, so there's no moisture in that soil to cause that seed to swell anyway. And then we have a 90% chance of rain. We're going to have one big storm pass through, and it's going to dump an inch of rain. Well, that'll be enough rain to probably get that seed to germinate.
But what happens after?
Then you create this crust effect to where you have this seed just basically poking its head out of a slab of concrete. And then you have that sun just bearing down on that barren ground. I can go back on Google Earth images to back in the days of when we plowed, and I can see white patches where it's just dry, dry soil. I don't even think that's
rock now.
that's not even a good to call it soil.
Right,
it's
right.
Dirt. And so if you do that, you drastically lower your chances of success.
Right out of the gate, though.
Too many guys do that right now.
Yeah. I mean, it just – but that's why it's important, I think, to talk about, like, why and how that seed is going to germinate. It's germinating with moisture. It's not germinating because you put it in the dirt. Again, if it's just in the dirt and it's dry dirt, it's not going to germinate. It's got to germinate with moisture. So sometimes when we're talking about thatch layers – because you brought it up, you said, you know, if you're punching through and you've gone through and you've disked and it's just dirt, well, there's a seedling baking in the sun. There's zero residual thatch or growing vegetation around it to help shade it, keep it cool. Once it pops, then develops its root system, there isn't any of that. It's just out there in the elements, and dadgummit, it's August still.
And like, not only that, but the other thing is to consider the next rains, too.
Absolutely.
Because as that crusts over, you're creating a brick effect. You're creating a slab of concrete to where if you do get a 2-inch rain,
it's going
to
run off.
70%+ of that is running off, and it's not busting through that hard pan, getting into the soil, getting to those roots, getting to that seed to where if it hadn't germinated yet, it can now germinate.
But
and so that's something really, you see it too often, and that's especially important for the guys in a very loamy and clay, loamy or clay soil types.
Yes. And imagine now if you did have a thatch layer on there and you got that same rain, that water, the way it's going to fall on there, it's going to be broken up, dispersed. It's not going to just completely run off. It will infiltrate way more. And that rainfall, let's say you do get 2 inches, maybe now 60% gets infiltrated into the ground. Now they've got a much longer period in which that seed itself has got moisture to establish and get growing.
Even
out of the gate
as
better.
Much as I rip on landscape guys and landscaping in general, and the modern lawn, even they're with it enough to know that they have to put down wheat straw whenever they put down new seed.
They put down
wheat straw for that very same effect. And now let's take a step back and tie it back into the analogy we used earlier about the paper towel germination test. And that is, that's a pretty doggone good way to understand your germination percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the reason it's used is because you have the perfect scenario. You've got moisture around that seed, allowing it to germinate as quickly as possible. So the question is, how do we replicate that in a food plot scenario?
Uh-huh.
How do you take the germination test in a paper towel, and you have a paper towel, it's sitting on top of a paper towel, and then it's folded over the top, holding moisture in? How do you replicate that? That's through thatch. That's through older plants or deteriorating plants laid over on the soil surface.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get that through disking and plowing.
No.
You get that through no-till drilling or broadcasting into standing vegetation and laying it over.
Laying that vegetation, boom, flat against the ground on top of that existing seed you broadcasted.
And it's crucial to note that that's, it's a three-step process. It's the termination. Usually what we do is...
Let's go step one, step two, step three. Very, very clear, because we get this asked so many different times. Let's go through it. Step one.
Step one is terminate the existing crop.
Correct.
Whether it be weeds or spring food plots, you terminate it. So we spray glyphosate and kill it while it's standing. The only stuff that's laying over is in your tire tracks.
Yes.
And even then, it's green vegetation typically that you're driving through, so a little bit of it comes back.
Yep. Before it eventually dies.
Step two, broadcast seed into that vegetation. So ideally, it's right after you sprayed. It could even be, you could even do it right before you spray. That's the only step where you can go one and two, could probably be switched back and forth. But it's just easier to say, number one is spray the field. Number two, broadcast the blend or broadcast broadcast it into the field. Step three, lay it over. Whether it be a drag or a roller, a cultipacker, or a low rider Chevy S10.
Or a bucket on the tractor. I don't care. Like,
just don't disturb the soil.
Yeah. So what just happened was if you had proper, let's say, herbicide applications before, you would have been able to go through and drive, kill the initial vegetation that's standing there, broadcast the seed, but that seed would have been able to make seed-to-soil contact because there have been some mulch or thatch there, but not an overwhelming amount on the ground existing. So there was some soil that seed could have come in contact with. So it's laying there on top, and then you come back and then put all the vegetation that was standing vertically, right, that was growing, you put that on top, and now it's laid horizontal against the ground, flat on top of the soil. You get rains. You get more infiltration of the water. You get a trapping effect of that water against the ground, against the seed, against the soil, and it holds there. The seed sprouts, and then it's protected by some of the existing vegetation and thatch layer that you had sprayed and rolled over, laid against the ground. As that root system develops, it comes through. Now it's got a root system, so it might be able to handle some browsing pressure, and it fills in, and your success rate of germination and of that food plot is usually very high. But one of the things I think we see so many times is either people get that, they try and do that technique, and they get the order mixed up, or they're trying to broadcast into like a sod-forming grass where the thatch layer initially was just way too thick right out of the get-go. Like it wasn't going to work because there still wasn't that mixture of some open ground, some just thatch that could have helped
or
protect some seeds.
The big question is, well, why can't I just mow? I hear that so many times with this process. Or they go out and they mow it first, and then they spray what grows back, and then they're expecting, well, I can just broadcast on it. Well, it don't work that way. You may get some growth, and we can say all this, but if you get rain every 4 days, that kind of eliminates a lot of the, you don't have to be as perfect in your planting techniques if you're getting rain every 4 days. Because
but
you got rain every 4 days, you could throw it out on this concrete that we're sitting on and grow something.
Yeah, but that's the point of it is you don't get that ideal world. Like this is Mother Nature. This is weather systems. It's going to hit you or it's going to miss you. And you might not get rain for a while. So you have to create that the best case scenario. And just doing it and following the steps appropriately is right. But what does mowing do?
If you mow before you plant, you create a very uneven distribution of vegetation. And typically it's really, really thick in one area and then very, very, very thin in other areas. So you don't get that even distribution of thatch laying over. And another thing, we're talking about the seeds that are germinating, because I know somebody's probably hearing that and thinking, well, if it's serving as mulch, Well, we use mulch and landscaping to try to prevent weeds from growing.
Right.
Well, we don't – the vegetation that's growing that is turned to mulch is not thick enough to do that.
No.
It will be if you mow it, and you'll notice where it gets really clumpy. Yeah, nothing's going to grow from the bottom of that pile because it's too thick. That's why if you lay it over, it's just the right distribution to where you can get really good success, because keep in mind, at the same time that mulch is laying there protecting that young seed, catching vegetation or catching moisture and holding that moisture over that seed, it's also decomposing.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time it starts to slowly decompose, that's when that seed or that plant bursts through and just and goes a lot better and thrives, because it's no longer trying to grow through that thatch.
Well, and I think it's definitely super important too to remember that when you like dry matter versus standing alive matter. So like, let's just say you had the Heritage Blend planted this year and you're like, I need to terminate that. I'm going to use that as my mulch to lay over, guys. Perfect. Great. If you have a really great thick stand of Heritage, and even if you go through and spray it, I would say reduction of, because of the loss of moisture and laying it over, of, you know, let's just say it was 100% full field, and that stuff grows thick. When it's a great stand, it is super thick. Like, you can't walk through
it's
almost.
It's an 8-foot curtain of vegetation.
Yes, it's amazing. But you spray it, it lays over, it shrivels up, and, like, the let's say, if you will, the loss of matter creates a perfect mulch layer evenly distributed across it. It's not like it's too thick to lay it over. You think of, like, a hay field when it's cut, and then finally it dries, and it's put back into windrow. It's like, oh, wow. Once it dries, it loses so much of its
grass.
Surface area. And that's exactly, that's grass.
If you've got cowpeas or soybeans or buckwheat, which we'll talk about later. So
millets.
If you want to hear our thoughts on buckwheat, keep listening. But those three, soybeans, lab, and or even lab, cowpeas, and then buckwheat, those break down so fast that you won't even be able to recognize them probably a month after you've sprayed them.
The only thing you will see, I think, is the Milo stalk and sun hemp stalks. You're like, oh, yeah, that's for sure that.
And millets, if they get tall enough, and if you planted the ancestor, you're going to see the sorghum sedan. Those
sorghum
grasses
sedan, yes.
hold up better. And then, of course, if it's 8 foot tall, you're still going to see it, and you'll even see it next spring.
Sure.
But if you if it's a short vegetation, you won't see your broad leaves and legumes nearly as long as you'll see these grasses. So keep that in mind as well. Like, you don't want to – this works best with good vegetation standing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work well if you've got a foot vegetation. You're like, well, I'm gonna lay it over. Well, you can. You just better be on your knees praying every night for good rain, because rain is, like we said, the one that can save you.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a bad food plotter look like a genius.
Oh, yeah.
If you're getting good rains. But the last 3 years, it's been awful.
Yeah.
It's been
very lackluster from a fall planting situation. But at the same time, though, we've been fortunate to be able to salvage by planting appropriately, understanding the way seeds germinate, work what they need, and have solid stands of food plots to be able to either hunt over, learn more from, see how deer and other wildlife interact with them, but just has to be done in an appropriate manner.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about preparation as well. One thing that seems to be a growing trend, especially with herbicide-resistant weeds, people are using other herbicides more than just your generic Roundup that people are going to get some sort of 41% glyphosate herbicide. And that's what they've been using.
A lot of areas, though, are having to resort to other herbicide.
In agriculture world, you're starting to see these dicamba, Liberty Link type beans people are using. And glyphosate or Roundup Ready beans aren't as popular because of herbicide resistant weeds. Therefore, that spilled over to food plot world for some guys who are in and around crop country.
Yep.
So they're using, let's say, 2,4-D. That's the one we want to highlight this week. I feel like we've talked about it in the past, but either they're not listening or they haven't listened to the podcast yet. But 2,4-D I think most labels are going to say that there's a 14-day residual effect where it's still ground active. So if you mix up a batch of glyphosate, 2,4-D, and water, and surfactant or whatever you want to use or whatever you're planning on using, if you have 2,4-D in that tank and you spray it, you should not, I repeat, hear me clearly, you should not plant your food plot for 14 days after you sprayed. But to be safe, try to shoot for over 20.
Bar none, 14. And I think that
I'm so tired of seeing this well mistake.
The moisture levels, I think, can dictate that residual impact, let's say. But you have to be very, very cautious of using that. One, 2,4-D just has a different reaction. It drifts a lot differently. So we need to be careful of that when applying. But then, two, the residual. If you're not timing things appropriately here, 14, 21, 3 weeks makes a heck of a big difference when you're going into the fall. You have a time window that you're losing growing degree days, and you can't really salvage them, get them back, unless you just have this weird fall where you have a 3 week later than normal frost. But like, you're going into a dormant season. It's not like the spring time frame where you know, I'll just wait 20 more days
and just hope I get some more rains.
And a lot of these things that people are planting during the fall have a very strong broadleaf component, so we've got to make sure you're understanding what it is you're applying and then respecting that residual so you don't do everything in vain and it just
because
never
not
work.
Only that, but if you go and you spray the field and you turn around and you plant a week later and you're like, why is it not growing? Well, whatever vegetation there is breaking down and breaking down and breaking down. So the next time when you do plant and it's 3 weeks after the initial spray, you don't have that thatch layer that's replicating your wet paper towel effect to where you have better germination. So you're now putting yourself behind the eight ball because you jumped the gun. And so that's where it's like,
read
be very cautious of using your 2,4-Ds.
Read the label. Again, all this stuff is right there for us to be able to read and understand and see. But we just need to be able to respect the label itself. Take that extra 5 minutes, read it, so we don't make, if you will, just bonehead mistakes. Like, we want the best success for you guys. So if you aren't resorting, needing to use it, be mindful of that when you're going into planting, broadcasting, drilling, whatever it may be, fall blends this year. We've seen it a lot. Going into the fall, but also the spring, that was just kind of like a reoccurring thing, unfortunately.
Yep. I'm trying to remember what was something else. Oh, so let's talk a little bit about soil health. Because I keep getting this question. Talk a little bit. So we always test stuff, I should say. Just because we have these blends with Stratton out doesn't mean that 20 years from now, we're going to be going, yep, plant the Heritage, plant the Legacy blend in the fall, and plant the Heritage blend in spring, because we're always tweaking.
If those need tweaked, we'll tweak them. If other ones need to be, we find another job, another situation.
Another region is the big one.
Yeah.
Okay,
we'll do it.
Let's tweak it a little bit. Mm-hmm. We can't sell sun hemp in Arkansas. Let's make the ancestry.
Yeah.
If you go into the South, you probably will see us recommend some different things.
Yeah.
If you go into the heat of the South, we are currently, I mean, we tested stuff this summer that was like, all right, let's see what this can do. Mm-hmm. And it's species that
unconventional.
You wouldn't think go into a food plot variety, and we planted them. Now, unfortunately, we had one of the driest Junes on record. But
not a great year for testing.
We still had growth, and we still had heavy browse, and it was like, whoa, this might be something.
This has got some legs.
Yeah. We're going to tweak it some more. So we're always testing. And so just because you see these blends currently doesn't mean that.
That's it. That's the end of the game. End of the line.
That's it. Now, I will tell you, Legacy Blend, There might be a few tweaks, but that's a pretty solid fall blend for us. Yeah. And Heritage even as well. Yeah. There may be a few variety changes, but for the most part, it's there. The foundation is there. But there's some other stuff for certain regions and techniques of ways to plant these that we're working on. And so we're always trying, and that's the awesome part. The thing I enjoy most is trying to develop and find the next one that makes it a little bit better than 1.0, that 2.0 is better and 3.0 is even better. Yeah. So that's some fun stuff.
We're going to have like the iPhone 11 out in a couple of years from the food plot version.
That's right. The one thing we did, so we already have, maybe take a brief pause here.
Oh, that, yeah.
There he goes.
Go get him.
That
boy.
Looked like a fire truck or like a first responder. Yeah. We already have seed in the ground on several plots.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say seed in the ground, I'm talking brassicas, annual clovers.
We're not talking necessarily about like completely changing. We're talking about planting techniques here.
Uh-huh.
You know, multi-staged
techniques. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one thing too that we should address on this food plot podcast, because we broke down the blends a couple weeks ago. This week we're going over some of the common things. Okay, why can't I plant in hot or dry? Plant in July or plant late July with brassicas? Why can't I do my cereal grains? Well, I think I said that, but we planted some cereal grains last week. Yeah, last week, Chad and I did. We broadcasted some cereal grains, hoping to showcase what happens when they mature too early.
Show the fail and then like why this is bad
for
the fall. And then, and I think this is so killer, we have to remember this. Fall annual food plots are not just for the fall. If you do that, if you're planting those grains right now in certain areas of the country, you're missing out on the spring, bar none, period.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's a huge flop. You went off the 15-foot high dive and
belly flopped
it, because if you're like, well, I want to have 20-inch tall oats by October 15th, well, I can guarantee you they won't be there come February 15th.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what you really – that's why cereal grains are a crucial part of a fall blend, because you need to have forage available through that winter, early spring stress period. And if you go just straight brassicas and you're in areas of high deer densities, they're probably going to eat it all, and you're going to have a mud patch during that time of the year that really needs forage available. And so we've got seed in the ground. We're going to be showing you guys some growth, hopefully, some interesting ways that we did it, and some different blends, some different species, varieties that aren't anything new, but we did plant them earlier than recommended. And so that's something cool that we have going on. So we'll continue to update you guys as that progresses, to let you know if it was a flop or a perfect 10.10.
Perfect dive.
A perfect 10. Okay. Soil health. Oh, this is
hot button.
It's like holistic management and soil health are the new key buzzwords.
Yes.
And native vegetation. Native that one's trending now.
Yes,
I don't know
is.
If you heard.
Trendy.
But,
trendy.
It's cool. And I'd like to say that, what's that song? I was country when country wasn't cool.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I was doing this when it wasn't cool. So
I'll be doing it till the gals come home.
When it comes to soil health, I really like Gabe Brown's approach, or his five-step process. And I won't try to rob it. I'll just say, point the light at him and say that's a really good one when it comes to soil health for a guy that makes his living on healthy soil.
Well, I think it, just bar none, it's just science. And we need to look at the fact that this is the way that the natural world works. And these principles are the principles to building, improving fertility of the soils that you have wherever you're at. And it's, again, it's not like we have been working, managing learning disturbances to promote natural vegetation. We didn't create natural vegetation. Gabe Brown did not create soil improvement practices. They're not created. They're just understood, and they're brought to light to a certain way that everyone can then apply them and make them useful to their property.
So listen to these five and go into your naturalist mindset of going, okay, pre-settlement, what we know that soil was very healthy on the Great Plains, even across the country. Yeah. Why so? And disturbance in the form of disking and tillage was not occurring. The only kind of main disturbance you would get was hoof action from mm-hmm. animals. So limit disturbance. Limit mechanical, chemical, and physical disturbances of the soil. So all those things were not occurring on a landscape pre-settlement.
Correct.
Armor, keep soil covered at all times. That's why we say tillage is not natural from the fact that we're turning the soil, but we're also just leaving the soil exposed until vegetation grows back. So we have to keep the soil, and that's what we're talking about, armoring the soil when we're using the paper towel analogy, is we're armoring that soil, we're protecting that seed, we're absorbing or holding that moisture around that seed. Diversity. Man, I don't care. Diversity is king. We say it every stinking podcast.
Again, when you're working with the natural world, monoculture is not a thing that just normally happens and that just persists in that manner. It's not. It is bad. It's detrimental to the overall system.
And I'm going to come back to that one.
Yep.
Because that's a big part of this one. So living root, as many months out of the year as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at nature, you're going to see warm season, cool season.
Yep.
And so you're going to see plants that do really well in the worst heat of the summer, and plants that, you know, there's a few sprinkles that just came down out of the heavens right there. And it's a clear sky above us.
Sure is.
But I felt it on my legs. And then you're going to see those winter, in the middle of the winter, you're going to be like, what is this? Like, it's green at the mm-hmm. crown of the mm-hmm. at the crown of the plant. Like, it's still photosynthesizing.
Well, but I think it's an important note, too. It's living root system. Dormancy
it's not
does
annuals.
Not mean, dormancy does not mean that's not living. Just because a tree is not green up top doesn't mean that's still not actively doing things in the root system during a dormant stage.
And this last one is a big one that I think a lot of people can forget because it's hard to swallow, the fact that you've integrated animals.
Uh-huh.
So specifically large herbivores.
Correct.
Like the bison herds pre-settlement, now it's cattle.
Correct.
So if you're a listener going, I want to build soil as quickly as possible because this is what makes my engine purr.
Mm-hmm.
You should be doing those five things. You shouldn't do it. I hate the corner cutting approach of going, okay, I'm going to remove that, and I'm going to remove that, and I'm going to remove that.
Well, this doesn't work for me, so I'm not going to do it. Well, then you're going to have subpar results.
Yeah.
Or it's going to take you a longer time to get there.
And so if you say, I'm going to remove that and that, but I'm still going to get the results, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You can't. You can't beat nature at its own game.
No.
And
trust me, people have tried across all these civilizations when we tried to domesticate everything and figure it out and just try and manipulate it in our own way.
Don't cheat the system.
The system doesn't care about your cheating. It will win.
So
it doesn't work.
If you really want to build soil fast, and by fast, I mean years.
Yes.
Because one thing we know about soil health is you can't build it in a course. You can't go out and plant for 2 or 3 years and say, I built soil in 3 years and not use any animals, especially large herbivores. No, not happening. If you believe you are, you put on some goggles and you're not seeing straight. So when it comes to these five principles, we talked about armoring the soil. We talked about, you know, diversity. And diversity is just, that's why we struggle with Eastern Red Cedar monocultures. We struggle with even warm season grass plantings where there's no forbs or legumes mixed in.
Even soybean monocultures.
Soybean monocultures are terrible. We use them in our system as a way to control weeds.
As a tool so we can go and plant diversity.
Yes, and later on. Yes. But there's nothing, if you're headed out on a highway and that highway is soybean monocultures, there's a dead end somewhere.
Yeah.
And it may not be a mile down the road, it may be 20 miles down the road, but it's a dead end road.
Well, you mentioned one of those dead ends as the dicamba necessities, you know, changing the chemistry of herbicides.
The next herbicide. What's the next herbicide? And that is a dead end road. But this one about monocultures. You can't build soil with monocultures.
No.
You just can't beat nature. And so
There's nothing that soil would like or dislike more than the living root system that's in it being this exact same. The when you're talking about soil fertility and you have to have a diverse root system to deliver and cycle the nutrients that all the roots are uptaking, the plants utilizing, everything.
Yep.
You can't accomplish all of that with one single fibrous root across 50 acres of a field. You can't do that with one tap root of 50 acres across field. It
can't be accomplished as quickly with just annuals too.
Correct.
One thing I see is
correct.
I'm gonna build soil and I'm gonna plant this annual blend or that annual species for years and years and years, and it's like, you could get there faster if you had perennials mixed in to where you have a deeper root system. Versus a 20-inch or a 12-inch annual root system that is going to be decomposing the next year.
Although we plant seeds, let's say within the top 2 inches of soil, we need to be concerned with soils 10, 12 foot deep, that entire profile in which the natural world, let's say, really, really works in from a root system standpoint, is so incredibly important to be mindful of that entire column of soil, not just the first layer, and not just adding soil. I think this is another super important thing. Like, how many times do you hear build soil, build soil, build soil? Well, God, dadgummit, there's some places in the world or that the Midwest, it's not the issue isn't need more soil. The issue is make it more fertile.
Yeah.
Let's fix it. A lot of places you can grow great crops and do fantastic things in areas that have maybe 8 inches of topsoil. You don't need 2 foot of topsoil to still have great results, but you need to make it fertile. You need to make it where it's functioning like soil should function.
You need trace minerals, trace nutrients mixed in. Instead of just putting N, P, and K, start trying to monitor and look at what other micronutrients you may be missing.
And that might be come through the form of planting a different variety or adding, supplementing other species into that.
Yeah.
They're going to mine those and create that.
Cattle.
Yeah. You just...
So, we say all this because we keep getting this reoccurring comment, question. People come in and ask us, what's your thoughts on buckwheat? And it's like, well, I like buckwheat. What's the question? Like, what do you want to know? Like, is it amazing? Is it what do you want to know? I like buckwheat, but it's got a very short maturing rate. It matures a lot quicker than some of our other species that we plant.
It's great on adding
pollinators really
phosphorus.
Like it, but it's not a native, and it's good at mining phosphorus, like you said. It grows almost
anywhere fast.
I could throw it on this barbecue grill we're setting by and water it once a day and it'd grow.
Yeah.
And bloom and 60 days.
Very hard seed that can be broadcasted, left out, can bake a little bit. Like, you can, to me, it's like you can get away with planting buckwheat anywhere. It's like a beginner crop
If you can't grow buckwheat, maybe you ought to set this one out. Because buckwheat is one of those, it's like, if I go out with a five species blend and buckwheat's in it, Yeah, I'm pretty There's good a chance really, buckwheat's going to grow.
Really good chance you're going to see it, and you're going to see it grow, and it's just it's pretty resilient. It can handle some browse pressure, too. Deer are going to eat it for sure.
Yep.
But all in all,
it's cool. There's it's good.
No, but yeah, but there's no silver bullet, and there's yeah. absolutely no way that one single species is going to be glorified in a way, whether you're food plotting, whether you're in agriculture, whether you're, it does not matter, that one single species is going to be the game changer.
Yeah.
That's not, so, again, how nature works.
If your goal is, I need to fix the soil, and I air quote that very loosely, and I'm going to build the soil, air quoted. Or I have a new food plot. It was just dozed out, and I need to get the soil prepped. I'm going to plant buckwheat to fix the soil. It's like, have we, let's look at nature as our model. That's where we try to go. Research that we read that comes out where it's like, oh, did you hear about this new research? And I always read it going, how does this fit into the nature as my model mentality?
Yeah.
And when it comes to building the soil or fixing the soil, there's nothing that fits into nature's model of, I'm going to do it with a monoculture.
No.
Nothing. It does nothing. And so buckwheat is cool. It's great. Deer like it. It's nice, but it's not in any way, shape, or form. Am I going to go plant a field of buckwheat and say, well, I'll do that for 2 years and my soil's fixed? No, it doesn't work like that.
I
hate to burst the bubble.
It does not work like that. It's not that easy. That's not nature. Nature is complex.
Yep.
So we need to understand the complexities and then adjust our strategies to better understand and complement the complexity. We can't go in with something that is so simple, so basic, and that is going to grow so easily and so quickly and say, boom, done.
Yeah.
That's not how it works. Come on. We're smarter than that.
Thing about it is, too, going back to that covering the soil or that thatch, and I mentioned it earlier when it's talking about terminating it, is if you take, you know, let's just play this game. Let's just go down this road.
Yeah.
You have planted an acre food plot in buckwheat, nothing but buckwheat, and it's up three foot tall. And you're getting ready to terminate it,
mm-hmm.
and you terminate it. So let's just say you spray glyphosate on it. You broadcast your seed, and then you lay it over. As I mentioned, buckwheat breaks down
really
fast.
Fast and shrivels up to about nothing.
You're gonna not have much thatch.
Yeah.
And so if you really are concerned about soil health and feeding the microbes, you need that diversity of species that will take a little bit longer to break down so there is food, because that's what that is. That armor on the soil is breaking down to feed those microbes. And if you have something that's just, if you have a field that's just straight buckwheat, that's not feeding your microbes nearly as much as a diverse planting.
If you have a monoculture and then you take away, let's say, that future food or the fact that this root system, despite being a monoculture across that field, you completely just shut the light off for that entire field itself.
Yep.
Now you're planting another seed probably relatively quickly, but that seed itself then still has to go through germination process, root system development to function, and then like there's just this window of time that is less
yep.
suitable for microbial activity in the soil for then you to get the results of, again, air quoting, soil improvement, soil fertility. It just bottled up. Go back to those five principles.
they don't make sense at all.
Oh gosh, we were just recently on Bear Hunting Magazine podcast with Clay Newcomb.
Yeah.
And said something, and it was, you can't cut corners in conservation.
Yeah.
Here's a perfect scenario of that. It doesn't work like this. It is more complex. It is more dynamic than just one single species. And we're not picking on buckwheat just to pick on buckwheat. It's simply because there's been lots of questions coming in about it. We could say the same thing for soybeans.
You could line it up and say, you could just take Heritage Blend and say, okay, why is Heritage Blend? Here's your Heritage Blend. There's 9 species. Why'd you choose that one? Why can't I just plant that one in a monoculture? Well, right. Same reasons.
Exact same,
same reasons.
Same reasons. Yeah.
But buckwheat just keeps coming up to us, and it's like, I don't know why we continue to have this conversation, but I want to address it because apparently there is an idea that you can fix soil with buckwheat, and you can only fix soil
with those
quickly
principles.
With the principles that nature has given to us, and that is diversity, limit disturbance, armoring the soil, living root year round, and then integrated animals. And the other thing too, when we say integrated animals, people ask, why not deer? Why don't deer qualify?
Yeah.
Well, that's an animal.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Typically, yes. But think about deer feeding patterns.
Yes.
They'll be eating and then going to the bedding area and doing a lot of their
defecating.
So those nutrients that they pulled out, broke down, aren't just being left on the field or on the plot like they would with a cattle.
Grazing tendency, and this is why it's super important when it says and specifies like large herbivores and the way that they move across a landscape, not only in their feeding patterns, but in the way that they socialize with each other. Like, they move in groups, they move in units, and the way that they do that will distribute relatively evenly based on the forages, manure, nutrients, fertilizer, onto the landscape in a specific way that, although it is chaotic and kind of random, relatively uniform the same way.
Yeah. And not just manure, but urine and saliva are crucial in that building of the soil.
Definitely. And you don't have that because deer, they retreat back to cover.
Yeah.
And take
care of
all that.
And they move quickly anyway. It's not like they come and stand and eat, and then...
Yeah,
go and lay down.
It's a different animal, a different beast.
So no, stop it. If you're gonna send me that email, stop. Just go ahead and erase the email
backspace
you had typed out. that's kind of the big ones that have happened here lately for us. The testing and just the reminders that, you know, seed to soil contact, although it is important, moisture is more importanter. And so.
Spell check on that email.
And so
I tell you what, that day seed moisture. I mean, moisture is more important.
That's right.
Yeah. Good Lord.
What did Chad tell me today? He said twice. It rained down there twice.
Gosh, he is so from Southern Missouri.
Twice. That is a common phrase.
Oh, hear
up
that
here.
A bunch.
Yeah, and I noticed that East Coast people don't say their H's either.
What's that?
You say.
Herbicide,
yeah. Like we're spraying our herbs, and you say herbivores. Herbicide. It's got an H at the beginning.
Well, how do you say herb? Do you call it a herb?
I say it's an herb, but that's when I'm talking about herbs. How do you say horses? Horses?
No, it's a horse. But if you just put side, herbicide.
Herbicide. Is that how they spell it, or do they spell it herbicide?
You're talking about spelling
well, then
and
you said,
sane are two different
things. And
then
you said herbivores.
Yeah.
You didn't say herbivore.
Herbivore.
You said herbivore. I was like, I don't know, they must spell that differently than the way I
spell
it. Spell
the same. It's just the way you pronounce things.
Yeah.
But twice is just a made-up word.
That's right. Twice. So the farm got rained twice today. Twice.
How much rain?
Not much. Enough.
Something's better than none.
I think we got 2 to 3 tenths is what they're saying.
Well,
so.
But based on the last week, though, with considerable rains over the past
last
6 days.
The last week, we probably have... One day we had an inch. Another day we had like 4 tenths. So I think all said and done, we have maybe an inch and a half in 5 days.
A solid.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah, for a midsummer.
How did we record our podcast last week? We didn't record on Sunday night like we typically do.
We had recorded earlier in the week, I believe.
Yeah. And I want to shout out as we're wrapping this up. Guys, really be checking out the YouTube channel. More videos going up. That's search Land and Legacy. Also, really be tuned in for this fall. We're going to have some guests on over the next couple of months that are going to be really, really interesting. You might not expect it from us. So, yeah, check them out. Make sure you're tuned in and not missing out on these podcasts coming.
Subscribe.
And then
some giveaways, too.
Yep. So check us out on social media, Land and Legacy, Instagram, and Facebook. And then also virtual property valuations.
Yep. Going into fall preparations, I think, is a really key time frame where we see a lot of virtual property valuations come through.
As we try to limit the traveling during the fall more, so we can hunt, we try to lean on virtual property. So if you guys have questions, even hunting strategies.
Oh, yeah.
If you're looking for food plot scenarios, food plot layouts, food plot architecture, or hunting strategies, check it out, landandlegacy.tv. Go to the consultation tab, scroll to the bottom, see virtual property evaluations. That's it. That's all I got. We'll catch you guys next week.
Yep.